This is A Word, a podcast from Slate. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. It's Pride Month, a time when LGBTQ Americans celebrate and look to strengthen civil rights for their community. But as Republicans villainize LGBTQ people in rhetoric and the law, and militia groups target them for violent attack, this Pride Month feels a bit more complicated. That may be especially true for Black LGBTQ Americans who are feeling targeted on two fronts.
I know for me, like I always realize, no matter how much I think we've progressed, I'm kind of always, you know, on guard. You know, to hold my boyfriend's hand on the street is still revolutionary.
Black LGBTQ pride coming up on A Word with me, Jason Johnson. Stay with us.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Welcome to A Word, a podcast about race and politics and everything else. I'm your host, Jason Johnson. It's Pride Month, and LGBTQ Americans, along with allies, are attending marches, rallies, and other celebrations of the community. But this pride comes at a time of uncertainty and heightened violence against LGBTQ people. Republicans are openly vilifying gay, lesbian, and transgender people, and now violent militia groups are targeting pride events, from parades to drag queen story time. For African Americans in the community, this disturbing trend comes on the heels of a backlash after the racial reckoning. Joining us to talk about it is Clay Kane. He's the author of Live Through This, Surviving the Intersections of Sexuality, God, and Race. He also hosts the Clay Kane Show on SiriusXM. Clay Kane, welcome to A Word.
What's up, Jason? Thank you for having me, brother.
Before we start, I'd like to warn listeners that this will be a frank discussion about homophobia, and our guest will talk about his experience of being called an anti-gay slur. Clay, I just want to ask, especially in the context of the attacks in Idaho and across the country against the LGBTQ community, how are you marking Pride this year? And does it feel different this year in the wake of mass shootings and both policy and physical violence to celebrate this month?
You know, it does feel different. And it actually reminds me of when I used to go to Pride in the late 90s. And I can recall going and maybe not thinking of mass shootings, but knowing that if you turn down the wrong block, knowing that if some alleged straight people turn down the wrong block, that you might experience violence. And I can recall there's an area in New York City called Christopher Street. And I can recall crossing Christopher Street to make it on this side called the Pier for LGBT folks out there in New York. That was to some degree, still is a very popular area that younger LGBT folks would go. And folks driving by in New York City, late 90s, would throw bottles at us, would scream faggot at us, would say the N-word to us, or say spick. When I was going to Pride, I eventually, this is late 90s, maybe early 2000s as well, I would only come out at night, because I just didn't feel safe being out there during the day. And I know folks might say, well, isn't it scarier at night? Well, I guess the crowds are going and it's a different kind of atmosphere. But yeah, I'm certainly feeling that now. I'm feeling like our right to exist is at risk. And I also feel like a lot of white LGBT organizations don't get the intersections. I think about I'm just going to be honest here, organization like the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, that I think has failed in many, many ways. And so I think for Black LGBT folks specifically, that there is a sense of our safety at risk. And yeah, so I feel that, and it's a strange feeling. And I know for me, like I always realize, no matter how much I think we've progressed, I'm kind of always, you know, on guard. You know, to hold my boyfriend's hand on the street is still revolutionary, especially for two Black men. You know what I mean? So I certainly feel that with the policies and with it also being celebrated. You know, it's being celebrated that, oh, gay people are taking over and so-and-so's taking over. It's this, there's been this shift where pushback against a group who some people feel like it's the alphabet community. They're complaining too much because I guess they see gay as being a white thing. So where does that leave Black LGBT folks? So, yeah, I felt a difference.
So I'm glad because there's so much in that I want to unpack. When I was, again, talking to some friends of mine, they were commenting on the fact that I was like, yeah, I'm going to go to the Pride Parade on Sunday with some friends, really excited. And many of the Black gay men that I know were like, eh, mm-hmm. that's the white pride event.
Right.
Here we are in 2022. Do you think there has there been more integration in pride events?
Well, on the surface, you'll see more quote unquote diversity. But as far as all the pride, you know, those pride marches, they are very profitable. They bring in a lot of money. So, but the higher ups who are orchestrating all the pride events, they're all white gay men. And let's be clear. Pride was not about rainbows. It was not about corporate parties. It was a revolutionary act against police violence. That's what it was about. That's the roots of Stonewall. That's the roots of Pride. Pushing back against police. Pride was radicalism. So I think like Marsha P. Johnson and Sylvia Rivera kind of be rolling in their grave to see that's the way that it's corporatized. But on the outside, yeah, but where it matters, where who's getting the check, where who's getting their little rainbow check, no, the diversity isn't there at all. Because there, people forget that there is this issue of racism in the LGBT community. And I got to be honest with you, Jason, I haven't been to a mainstream Pride event in probably 15, 20 years, maybe. I just have no desire to be there.
You talked about the Human Rights Campaign. How do you think these sort of white-run LGBTQ groups that you've talked about, have they done a good job at all of addressing racial reckoning since George Floyd? Are they still sort of like, well, we threw a dollar and wore a Black Lives Matter sign during the parade and that's it? How do you think those organizations have handled these issues?
Well, it depends on what you consider racial reckoning to be. You know, so if you consider racial reckoning to be releasing a statement and putting Marsha P. Johnson on your website, then I guess they have done they've had some progress for people. But the issue of organizations like HRC and plenty of other organizations is that this has been an ongoing problem that Black LGBT folks have been talking about for decades. So the kind of a repair they would need to do, the kind of come to Black Jesus moment they would need, really goes beyond this moment that people had in 2020. So no, I mean, there's still a deep issue there. And I think where I am is that I feel like similar to Black communities at large is that I don't even want to support these kinds of organizations. I don't want to ask you to see me. I don't want to have to explain my right to exist to you. I don't want to have to do a 101 on race, you know, for you. So I've even moved beyond just being in the space. I just feel like we can create our own spaces. And I feel like there are so many powerful Black LGBT folks on social media that have their kind of own platforms that we can elevate that. That do we really need these traditionally white conservative? And I know, folks, you think there's no way an LGBT person can be conservative, but truly conservative organizations begging to support us. And I say the answer to that is no. If we can support and build our own in whatever way that is, you know, we're not going to, you know, you see what happened with a Black News Channel, you know, maybe that's not the way to do it. But whatever way that it is, to realize we don't need affirmation from them.
Have there been Black LGBT groups that have come to the fore to fill in the spaces, to fill in the gaps where Pride, where HRC isn't, other organizations aren't?
Yeah, there has, especially in Atlanta. You know, we've seen, and Vision Church in Atlanta does some really great work. Bishop Allen does some really phenomenal work. They launched a new platform, I believe it's called Elevate, where they're really showcasing and highlighting Black LGBT content creators. But here's part of the issue, and a lot of this goes to numbers, right? So Black folks are, what are we, 12% of the population now after that
more or less
horrible,
yeah,
census, you know, debacle? Right. So we have Black folks, just Black folks at large, 12% of the population. Then let's say you go to Black LGBT folks. Well, you're slashing that number down to maybe less than 6%, less than 5%. So mm-hmm. And then let's say you're just looking at black gay men. Because, you know, there's also issues within black gay men and black trans folks, right? You know, black gay men can have misogyny. Black gay men can have transphobia. So it really is a niche within a niche within a niche. And so how do you elevate that in a particular way where it can reach people that it needs to reach? So for me, I say that a lot of this goes to funding and money and dollars, that we have to have realistic expectations, and we have to not say that we're going to compete with the organizations that have been around for a long time and from straight organizations that feel like all LGBT folks are in the same category.
We're going to take a short break. When we come back, more on Black perspectives on LGBTQ pride with Clay Kane. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about African Americans and LGBTQ rights with journalist Clay Kane. Clay, this is something that I have noticed. I am old enough to remember in the late 80s when I first started seeing commercials celebrating Black History Month and MLK Holiday. And I remember like being a kid and it'd be like, you know, free at last. Well, these mattresses aren't free, but they're discounted because, you know, like it was crass and it was tacky, but it was like 1988. And it was the first time I saw large corporations trying to commodify Black History Month. There's been a lot of commentary I've seen online about that with Pride Month, where you have these organizations do these, I guess, sometimes well-intentioned, but sometimes extremely strange ads that supposedly show their support for the LGBTQ community. There was I think I actually texted you this. There was the Burger King ad that like put two tops and two bottoms of the buns on some burgers. And I was like, this is cringe, right? Like, help me. I think this is bad. What have you thought about that? I mean, as someone who, you know, is a gay Black man in media, what have you thought about the sort of commercialization of Pride Month? Is that a good thing? Is that a sign that themes are sort of being mainstreamed? Or is it more sort of hypocrisy? Because a lot of these same businesses and corporations give money to right-wing candidates who are anti-LGBTQ.
You know, I really struggle with this. So the only images that I saw, let me be very specific, of gay men, of Black gay men when I was younger was in pornography. And that's not me to shame any kind of pornography. That was just my first image of seeing two men showing intimacy to each other. So the part of me that has my issues with capitalism and corporations, it disgusts me because I know they're taking a movement that is so anti these massive corporations who do not give a F about you after they get your dollars for LGBT pride. So it's disingenuous. It's obviously, you know, they realize it's marketable and it's rainbows. It's all these rainbows. So it almost looks, you know, fairy tale-ish or whatever. So there's that side of it. And that frustrates me. And I know it's insincere. But I will say, outside of the rainbows, I will say that when I see a commercial, not necessarily when I see imagery of LGBT folks or Black gay folks, I do wonder, wow, I wonder if I would have saw that when I was a kid. Maybe I would have hated myself a little less. Maybe I would have stopped trying to pray the gay away. Maybe I would have not been so impacted by bullies who were calling me a faggot every day. Maybe as I was running from my life after school, hoping to not get my teeth knocked in, that maybe I would have realized that it wasn't me that had the issue. It was them who had the issue. So I think for as complicated as it is, and again, it's not genuine, I do feel like if I were a kid and I saw that, it would have had a really important impact on me. And I know a lot of folks, you know, feel like Lil Nas X isn't that great of a singer or whatever. But I do know, I mean, if I would have saw a black, I mean, I heard of like Elton John maybe, but that's about all I really knew. And Elton John, you know, you knew he was gay, but he really didn't say anything. He didn't like show intimacy on camera. If I would have saw a Lil Nas X, a hip hop pop star, you know, showing intimacy with a guy and having songs of how he wants love like anybody else, that would have had an impact on me. So it's complicated. On one end, the older person in me is disgusted by it. It's annoying. I know it's disingenuous. But on the other end, as trite as it sounds, representation does matter, and it really can affirm you. And so does the end satisfy the means? Maybe.
So when it comes to representation, and you and I, again, have had this conversation sort of on and off air, where do you see the state of black queer representation in TV and movies? Now, I will say this. You know, I see the CW launching this new show, Tom Swift, right? About this, you know, 20-something gay black man who's like flies around the world and solves crime and everything else like that. And I think, and he has this sort of tension with his bodyguard that I'm like, okay, cool. But I've seen a lot of other instances in commercials and this new show on Netflix, First Kill, that the idea of black on black love in the queer community is still very rare.
When you think of the images that they're choosing, me and my friends in my circle will be like, yo, when can we see if just being two black gay men? And I never forget when I interviewed Jussie Smollett. I know folks have issues with him. This is before that issue. He said in Empire, they wanted to make his boyfriend white. And Jussie told me on air, he said, F no, we're not doing that. Jamal Lyon is going to have a black boyfriend. The truth of the matter is that black gay men are a very insular community. And what I mean by that, according to the CDC, black gay men are known to date other black gay men more than any other demographic. But you wouldn't think that's the case. So you want to have your love affirmed, because I always say we got to look at LGBT folks above the groin. Everybody obsesses over LGBT folks below the groin. So you want to have your love affirmed in your sexuality because you know how you might be hurt in your church or in your school or in your community. But you also want to have it affirmed in your racial identity, because I grew up thinking gay was a white thing. I didn't even know black gay folks existed. I didn't even know they were. I just thought it was a white thing. I'm like, yo, what's going on? And then, of course, you're being called a faggot in school and all these kind of things. So it's so important to see that. It's important to see that not just in gender or not in sexuality, but also in race. And we just don't see enough of black gay folks together, black lesbian couples together. And then when you see the lesbian couples, it's definite. It sometimes appears to be a way to appeal to, you know, straight men. So it's a lot. So for me, it's important for me to see black love and varying examples of black love. And you know what? Shout this out. One of the greatest examples of that, and we have to go to our own, a lot of folks don't know about it, is a Native Son. Emil Wilbekin, he does Native Son. He showcases black love all the time. They have annual events, and a lot of folks don't know them, but Emil built that from the ground up. They do amazing, amazing work. And so I sometimes have to look to that, but I definitely agree with you. And again, if you're a young black gay person and you see, you know, their tokenism, it can be a bit frustrating.
Along those same lines, this actually just popped up in the news this week, and I thought it was fascinating. I was like, great, I'm going to ask Clay about it. Michael Sam is actually back in the news.
Yes, he is.
For context, the audience who may not remember, Michael Sam was Defensive Player of the Year in the SEC in like 2014. Before he entered the draft, he came out publicly and did big interviews and said, hey, you know, I'm a gay black man, blah, blah, blah. And many people speculated that that had a harmful impact on his draft position. And he never played it down in the NFL. And yet just last year, right, we had an openly gay player on the Raiders. And I think he was like part Middle Eastern or something else like that. I remember the gentleman's name. looking at Michael Sam as a time capsule, right? 6 years ago, you can't even get into the league as a gay black man, as a player. Where do you think the state of sort of black LGBT issues are in sports right now? Do you think we're getting closer to the day where, you know, somebody will show up to their press conference and say, hey, this is my partner? Do you think we're getting to a point where that wouldn't be an absolute end to someone's career as it might have been for Michael Sam? Or do you think that that is still one area of American society where it's like, no, this is not going to be open anytime soon for people to live their full lives publicly?
I think it's going to be difficult because part of sports is selling hyper-masculinity. And sadly, a lot of people, they only associate people associate hyper-masculinity with being straight. And so how can you be masculine? How can you do what's considered to be a masculine sport and be a straight man? They see being gay as being weak. And there's nothing wrong with being masculine or feminine, obviously. But people associate mannerisms with gender. So I think it's going to be really tough. I will say this, though. I never forget years ago, I've said this on TV before, when when there was all that controversy of homophobia in the NFL, this is before Michael Sam, the NFL, Roger Goodell, they sat down with GLAAD. They sat down with every LGBT organization. They flew GLAAD in and they had an epic meeting. And GLAAD had a 50-point plan.
Wow.
Strategy. Execution. Because, you know, now they get fined for saying something homophobic and crazy. GLAAD laid it out. And now homophobia in the NFL, you know, I know it's still there and there aren't a lot of openly gay folks there. But nonetheless, as far as they're celebrating pride, they're doing all these things because there were actual demands made and they got a return in it. And so I always find that interesting. And then folks say, oh, the LGBT, they asked it for so much. Some of them are demanding it. And they're getting it, and they're putting dollars on the line for it. So, but as far as actually being a player, I think it's going to be tough. You know, we have this idea that young people are so evolved and they've grown up and they racism, homophobia. Nah, it's not. I mean, what's his name, Brian Flores. Mm-hmm. I mean, if we can't even get a black coach to not be vilified,
right?
You know what I'm saying? In the NFL, we're a long way from an LGBT person or a black LGBT person being able to play. And, you know, I think a lot of us, we just want to be able to live our lives. I mean, I have friends who are in their 50s and they have really prominent jobs and nobody at the job knows about them because they just don't feel comfortable. The day-to-day lives of people just not feeling safe. That if I say this, I'm not going to get fired, although in some states you can be fired for being LGBT, but I'm not going to get that promotion.
Right.
You know, I know friends who are in like 5-year relationships and they've never brought their partner to work.
Wow.
Because they just don't feel safe and they know what the reaction is going to be. So you accept it and you create your own world and your own circle with the people that you know. And you see a pride flag and you say, good. But how does that impact your daily life? Your daily, daily life. I know people who live in the South and they may be HIV positive and they're fighting for fair health care and they can't get it. So these are the day to days that people live through and go through. And so if they are at work and Michael Sam comes up, they don't say a word.
Right.
Because they know all this, you know, they know what the conversation, they're at the barbershop. Mm-hmm. Michael Sam comes up. They're not going to say a Little Nas X comes up. They're not going to say a word because they don't even want to. That is not the moment where they feel like arguing for their right to exist.
It's fascinating when you talk about comfort in the workplace. From your perspective, when we talk about corporate America, is there a space where the gay black male coworker or the lesbian black woman coworker is now sort of a virtual signaling commodity? That's another level of pressure. Do you see that sort of thing happening either in corporate America where it's like, well, we're gonna have this gay black man because it makes us look diverse, but we don't really care about his lived experiences. We just like having him there.
See, I don't know. It's complicated because I feel like some people are okay with you being gay as long as they don't see it.
Mm, yeah.
So I feel like people are oftentimes freaked out when they see somebody with their partner.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like they're disturbed if they see a quick peck on the lips,
mm-hmm.
or a holding of the hands, or a picture of your partner on your desk.
Mm-hmm.
What I've heard from my friends, I don't work in corporate America anymore, is that, okay, if they find out, that's fine, but they don't want to see it.
Mm.
And it's interesting you bring up the example of an interracial relationship. Me and my friends always say this, that our fathers would rather we come home with a white woman any day over a black gay man. Like if I told my father I was marrying a white woman, I mean, you know, he would be okay with that,
right.
Versus knowing that I'm in a relationship with a black gay man. So I think people, you know, people act like they're threatened by whatever they think people do in bed.
Right.
But I think they're really threatened by love.
Mm.
I think they're really threatened by people being happy.
Right.
That's really the threat, that there's something about that. And I know for a lot of people, they think, you know, again, they think it's a weakness thing and you're not a good representation of black men. You know, I'll never forget, Jason, my first time I went to Harlem, and as I was walking down the street, I saw a shirt in the window. It was a black shirt and white letters. And it said, "A real man doesn't do drugs.
Hmm.
A real man loves God. A real man does not sleep with men."
Wow.
Never. It was
on a t-shirt
in the window.
Wow.
On a t-shirt. Black shirt and white letters. It was like an uppercut. Because all my life, I've been taught how to deal with racism.
Mm-hmm.
From my father, my grandfather, even my mother who's white. All my life, I've been taught how to deal with racism. But I was never really prepared how to deal with, that isn't even homophobia. That's just like that kind of ugliness.
Right, it's just violence.
And yeah, and that almost impacted me more. I've experienced more racism, mm-hmm. but it almost impacted me more because it came from my own community.
Mm-hmm.
So it hurt in a different kind of way.
Wow.
It hurt in a different kind of way.
We're going to take a short break. We come back more about black gay rights. This is A Word with Jason Johnson. Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
You're listening to A Word with Jason Johnson. Today, we're talking about Pride Month for Black Americans with author and radio host Clay Kane. So, Clay, I understand you're working on like a graphic novel or cartoons, dramatizing the life of civil rights organizer Bayard Rustin. Just, you know, I love comic books. So can you tell us a little bit about this project?
All right. So it's not completely a graphic novel. I'm working on a project with John Lewis's production company with creating short form comic books, if you will, for the Department of Education in New York City. And of course, for folks who don't know, Bayard Rustin was the architect of the March on Washington. He was Dr. King's right hand man, and he was basically erased from history. This is a guy who did incredible, incredible work, and it was an attempt to erase him. And you've really seen a resurgence of him now. So it's really cool that I could. I'm sure we'll get banned somewhere.
That's your goal. You want to get banned, then you know you did something.
Yeah, get banned. But it's really cool to be able to highlight him in a comic book, storybook kind of format. So it should be out in the fall.
Let's say I have a son or daughter, right, who knows their identity. It's like, hey, mom, dad, I'm queer, I'm gay, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. When it comes to, say, political leaders, right, you're talking about Rustin, name two or three political leaders maybe that have been erased in the past or today that you would want a 9 or 10 year old kid or a 13 year old to hear about that would help them sort of live in their identity and say, hey, there is a space for me. I don't have to go through 6 or 7 years of hating myself. I can be like this woman or that woman or that man.
Well, there's Alan Locke, name people don't know, one of the great leaders of the Harlem Renaissance. It wasn't just Langston Hughes. It wasn't just Zora Neale Hurston, folks who I love a lot. I would encourage looking him up. He was really a social and political leader during the Harlem Renaissance. There is A. Philip Randolph, of course. A lot of folks don't know that he was LGBT. They weren't saying that back then. They were saying homosexual. And A. Philip Randolph, he planned the first March on Washington, which was canceled. I shouldn't say canceled, but they decided to not do it because I believe Eisenhower gave in to desegregating the national defense industries. So A. Philip Randolph is a name that we often forget. And I tell people, you know, go back and research his history and research his work. And lastly, I would say, I'm trying political in a very particular kind of way. Maybe she isn't a politician, but I just think of her as a warrior, and I encourage folks to revisit her story. And it's a name that you probably know, but it's Audre Lorde. Audre Lorde was a writer, and she was often X'd out of Black radical literary circles because she was a lesbian. So those are names that I think back, and I think that they inspire me. And of course, other writers as well, like Alice Walker and so on. But the other thing that I always say, too, is that, you know, one of the things that I always hear is people say, well, I don't agree with that, quote unquote, lifestyle. First of all, it isn't a lifestyle, but I don't agree. But saying you don't agree would be like saying you don't agree with the sun rising or the sun setting. Being attracted to the same sex or the opposite sex is as natural as the sun rising or the sun setting. So there is nothing to disagree with. And for Black folks, we don't have the space, the time to throw away other Black people. We can't throw away Angela Davis. We can't throw away, like I said, Alice Walker. We can't throw away Black LGBT folks, the founders of Black Lives Matter. We can't throw them away. They are a part of our community. We need all of us collectively, because a lot of white LGBT folks are throwing away Black LGBT folks. We don't want to do that. We need each other. We collectively need each other. And that's what I want us to all, when I see these Twitter wars on social media and the alphabet community, and we're a part of this together day by day. And that's what I want people to really remember, especially in the Black community, that we don't have time to throw each other away. We need each other collectively at the voting booth, at a march, on social media, in media. We all need each other.
Clay Kane is the author of Live Through This, Surviving the Intersections of Sexuality, God, and Race, and the host of The Clay Kane Show on SiriusXM. Thank you, man, so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Jason. I appreciate you, brother.
And that's a word for this week. The show's email is aword@slate.com. Our producer is Jasmine Ellis. This episode was produced by Eric Aaron. Alicia Montgomery is the Vice President of Audio at Slate. Our theme music was produced by Don Will. I'm Jason Johnson. Tune in next week for Word.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from, with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere, and each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.